If you please record, my name is Gene Haygood. I've represented Danny Lofton throughout the 8 years that this case has been in existence from the time that the original came in and obviously until present. The issues in controversy to this court revolve around the Court of Appeals' four-year failure to consider all of the evidence that we were able to present to the jury. And their failure to properly consider the test for proximate cause, that is both elements, in arriving at their decision. As a result of the last opinion handed down by the Court of Appeals, part of the issues that the court will be concerned with is whether or not it is proper for a Court of Appeals in this situation to furnish us with their perception of the law of mathematics and physics, and then to develop from that a time and space factor, and then to develop from that a method by which to defeat the jury's finding and the trial court's judgment in favor of the plaintiff or in favor of Mr. Lofton. In looking at this case and studying it for the presentation, it became necessary for me to find at least some ground by which I think we can all agree on some propositions that are beyond dispute. First of all, back in 1957, this court determined that it is common knowledge that thousands of cars every day end up on the wrong side of the road. By making that assertion, I do not want this court, nor do I want anybody to assume that I am acknowledging that Andy Lofton did what the jury ultimately found he did, and that is move from the shoulder of the wrong side of the road, crossing the lane of traffic Mr. Johnson's lane of traffic over to his side. Obviously, Mr. Lofton was not able to help me a whole lot in the presentation of the case, and that his memory, because of the injuries, simply would not allow him to remember. However, there was evidence to suggest that, and because there was evidence, we have not contested that finding on appeal. Secondly, the duty arises to operate a vehicle at a non-negligent rate of speed, at least in part, because of the obligation of the driver to make sure that he has the opportunity to take evasive action, that is, stop or slow down or turn or whatever it may take to avoid an accident if one becomes imminent. The third thing I think we can all agree on is that the definitions of proximate cause and the two elements of proximate cause, that is cause in fact and foreseeability, cause in fact being ultimately determined by the but-for test. I think it's also been called contributed to or substantial factor test, but ultimately I think it boils down to the but-for analysis. Fourth thing is the foreseeability, the second element of proximate cause, and that is whether a reasonably prudent person could anticipate the danger to others created by his negligent act, or the way the jury is instructed, whether it's foreseeable that this event or some similar event would occur. The cases are legion that hold that it is not required of any party, whether the plaintiff or the defendant, to prove exactly or that it is foreseeable the exact circumstances of what might occur, the exact way that an accident may occur, the exact damages that may occur.
Mr. Haygood, the Court of Appeals had all these elements before them, and all the evidence, and that's why the evidence is sufficient.
Yes, sir. This court, the first time when it came up on the per curiam opinion that was handed down, specifically told the Court of Appeals that they did not consider all the evidence, that they applied the improper standards and made conclusory statements, the same type of statements, Judge, that the Court of Appeals again made in direct contravention of this court's decree. And that is that Mr. Lofton, it's irrefutable that Mr. Lofton, quote, jumped, unquote, out in front of the Johnson vehicle.
We send this case back to the Court of Appeals after asking them to do it. And they take out that word, it was the same result, but they got that language that you objected. Where are we?
Judge, if that is the only thing this court, the Court of Appeals does, there will still be a number of errors that the Court of Appeals would have, if the same decision is made and let that word out, there are going to be a number of errors. First thing, the Court of Appeals applied the wrong test when making a determination as to whether or not the negligent speed of Mr. Johnson was a causing factor. Here's the way they made, or they approached it incorrectly. Throughout the decisions of the Court of Appeals, through the concurring opinions, all the way through the majority opinions up through today, they have continually held that the test for making a determination as to whether or not speed was a cause in fact was whether there was time or enough time for Mr. Johnson to take evasive action once Mr. Lofton entered into his lane of traffic. Very candidly, I believe because of my briefing on that and proving by briefing that could only apply if there was not restricted visibility in the way that we have here in our case. That could only apply in that situation. And because of that, I believe the Texas Bryan has rebriefed and reconsidered their position and now takes the position that the test is whether or not there was time to take evasive action, period. Judge, that is an incorrect standard by which to apply. The reason is because the time to take evasive action is directly dependent upon how much or what the speed of the vehicle is. The less amount of time there is to take evasive action, then the more, if we believe the Court of Appeals, the more chance there is for there not to be a finding of cause in fact, which means that the faster you go, the less time there is to take evasive action, and that simply cannot be the case.
But if there's too little, there's too little. If somebody darts in front of you and you're going only 20 miles an hour as opposed to 120, you're still going to hit them.
Yes, sir. But before you ever reach that decision, before you ever reach that, the jury must make a determination that the speed was negligent. Before you ever reach proximate cause and find liability or contributory comparative negligence, you must find that 20 miles an hour speed was negligent. And if you do, then the Supreme Court in the instructions that we received, at least the way I read it, in the Biggers case, tells us that, and what they did was take a non-negligent speed, and I think they used the 40 to 45 miles an hour, take a non-negligent speed and apply the non-negligent speed to the way that and then make a determination as to whether or not there was sufficient time to take evasive action. That is the very part that is being left out and not considered by the Court of Appeals and Texas Bryan in deciding this case. They have not in any way attempted to take a non-negligent speed and apply it to this reasoning as the Supreme Court did back in 1957 when they decided the Biggers case. And if the court does that, you will find that the very evidence that we have been able to produce fits within, or that the theory fits within the very evidence we were able to produce. Captain Rubel, the accident reconstructionist, testified that the reaction time and the lag time taken together is 2.5 seconds. That is a perception time and a mechanical time it takes for the brakes or the steering wheel to react through the system and do whatever you're trying to get it to do. Captain Rubel also estimated that there was 2 to 3 seconds of progressive movement that Lofton showed moving from the shoulder of the road across Mr. Johnson's lane of traffic before he reached the other side, or was, I think it was 7 to 8 feet before he reached the other side. Captain Rubel then testified that the time to clear, that is, the time it would take for Mr. Lofton to clear the lane of traffic of Mr. Johnson, was 1/4 of a second. And if you take all of that together and understanding that the accident occurred in Mr. Lofton's lane of traffic, that is 2.5 seconds plus 1/4 of a second plus whatever fraction of a second it would have taken for the accident to occur and Mr. Johnson to get over into the other lane is exactly that 2 to 3 seconds, that is the 3 seconds that Mr. that Captain Rubel testified, Mr. Lofton showed the progressive movement from one side to the other, which absolutely refutes the Court of Appeals decision that where they state that the evidence is irrefutable that Mr. Lofton jumped in front of Mr. Johnson's 18-wheeler less than 2 seconds before impact.
Well, assuming that the Court of Appeals statement that evidence is irrefutable is exaggerated or misstated or shouldn't have been made or whatever, do you complain that the Court of Appeals failed to consider any specific piece of evidence?
Yes, sir.
What specific piece?
The very piece of evidence that we just discussed, and that is the non-negligent speed that any prior fact could make a determination as to what that would be, and then apply the reasoning and the analysis that the Biggers Court, Supreme Court 1957, indicated should be applied.
Well, the Court of Appeals says that he might have been traveling 40, 45, or 50. Is there any other, that's Mr. Johnson's testimony.
Yes, sir.
Was there any other evidence that, of what speed he was driving that they failed to consider?
No, sir. That is the negligent speed that the jury found, and that finding is unquestioned here on appeal. The defendants here, the Texas Brian, does not complain about the finding of negligence, and that is the speed that the jury found. What the next step is that the Court of Appeals, when reviewing the cause and fact requirement, must do just as any trier of fact would in this kind of situation, and that is, what is a non-negligent speed in this situation? And if there is a non-negligent speed, which there is, and I have outlined that type of scenario in my case, Rivera, that would prove that if there was 0.25 or 1/4 of a second for Mr. Lofton to clear the lane, Mr. Johnson's lane of traffic, then that would have left, and if you make all the calculations, if my calculations are right, 0.83 seconds or over 3/4 of a second for Mr. Johnson going at a non-negligent rate of speed to have missed the accident.
And while that may be a theory that supports recovery, why can't the Court of Appeals say that there's just insufficient evidence to support it? That's a theory. It's not that there's no evidence, but the evidence is just not enough for rational people to make that conclusion.
There was, I think, one court at one time, or one of the judges at one time, found that there was insufficient evidence. There was another judge, I think, found that there was no evidence. And of course, Judge Janelle in dissenting opinion. I guess the court could, if they decided they wanted to violate what it seems to me that the courts have said, and that is, the appellate courts may not set aside jury verdicts on proximate cause on conflicting facts. They must have undisputed facts that are ample and clear, and the circumstances must be exceptional. And if they wanted, it seems to me, and all due respect to them, if they wanted to violate those requirements, they could do that.
Well,
but it seems to me if they follow...
Isn't that a no evidence question?
I mean, I'm sorry?
Isn't that no evidence? I mean, if they find no evidence of proximate cause, they should have rendered judgment against the plaintiff. Which
yes,
they didn't do.
Which
they just remanded it for a new trial.
Yes, sir, that's right.
Which just indicates insufficient evidence.
Yes, sir.
Which is to say that there was some evidence, more than a scintilla, in support of the plaintiff's theory, but the Court of Appeals finds that there's not enough to make it sufficient to support the verdict. Do you say that they cannot decide that on this record?
No, sir. I say they cannot decide that on this record if they apply the proper test. If they comply with the requirements of Biggers and do it properly, then I don't think that there's going to be any way, if they in good faith comply with it, that they are going to find any such evidence. They can take the argument that if Mr. Johnson had had one more cup of coffee, read the newspaper, or response to the application for writ of error, if he had gone back and kissed his wife one more time before he left. Those arguments are at best specious. Those acts are not considered to be acts of negligence. If you take it to its logical extreme, being born is a cause of it. But there is nobody in the world, and especially me representing Mr. Lofton, that's making any kind of complaint about Mr. Johnson being born or drinking another cup of coffee. That's not the act of negligence. The act of negligence is the speed. And when you hone in on the speed of it, or the speed of his vehicle, and apply the test that Biggers requires, then I think the ultimate opinion is virtually inescapable that there was completely sufficient evidence to support the verdict. Yes, sir.
So is there any evidence to support this theory, that no matter how slowly he had been driving within reason, the accident still would have happened?
I'm sorry, I don't understand that.
Is there any evidence to support this theory, that no matter how slowly Mr. Johnson had been driving, the accident still would have occurred? In other words, even if he'd been going 20 miles an hour, say, Mr. Lofton would have been in front of him before he had time to respond and would have hit him.
The only evidence that I attempted to put before the jury in an effort to simply to exemplify or emphasize to them, I think I'm answering your question, is what has been bannered around several years ago as my 1 second argument. That is, I asked Captain Rubel if Mr. Johnson had decreased his speed 1 mile an hour at 40, 45, and 50 mile an hour speeds, how long would he have had to have gone that reduced speed in order to avoid this accident? And the evidence came out 10 seconds, 12 seconds, and 13 seconds, or the average of, or the estimate of those speed. I think that's about what it was. So there was evidence that if he had slowed down any at all in response to the fog conditions, the darkness, the wet road, and what have you, then the accident would not have occurred. I don't know if I answered your question.
I'm asking you the opposite.
Okay,
is there any evidence of the opposite? In other words, is there any evidence against you that no matter how slow he would have been going, within reason, the accident still would have happened?
Judge, I don't remember any.
The defendant just didn't have any evidence.
I don't remember any evidence of that. I have not approached it candidly from that point. I've approached it as, where is my evidence to support me? I have not approached it from that point. I'm sorry.
What was the non-negligent speed?
The non-negligent speed is a speed somewhere less than 40 miles an hour. We know that it could be 39 miles an hour because I proved that at 39 miles an hour, if he had slowed down for 10 seconds at 39 miles an hour, this accident would never have occurred. Yes, sir. So it's below 40 miles an hour. And that's the best that I could limit it down. You know, obviously we could try to prove 1 mile an hour in fog so thick you couldn't see a foot in front of the hood of your truck. Maybe that was okay. But we did not get down that far. I thought it sufficient if I prove at some point the speed, at any given speed that Mr. Johnson testified to would be, if he was less than that, it would be sufficient enough to show that there was a non-negligent speed of 8.
So applying those facts, what is it that the Court of Appeals should have done with regard to this matter?
The Court of Appeals should have taken the Biggers case and the instructions there and said, is there a non-negligent speed by which Mr. Johnson could have been traveling, since the jury did find that it was negligence, at whatever speed he was going, 40, 50 miles an hour, whatever negligent speed that was, or whatever speed that was, that was negligence. Was there a speed less than that, that Mr. Johnson could have been going to where...
if they'd done that, the only speed that they would have had any evidence in the record on was less than 40 miles an hour. 39 miles an hour would have been okay.
39 miles an hour or less for that time period before. Yes,
and that
sir.
That was not contested in the record.
It was not contested to the extent that anybody questioned Captain Rubel, who was the only witness that testified to it. Nobody questioned that aspect of it that I recall, sir.
Okay, so they think 39 miles an hour, less than 40 miles an hour is a non-negligent speed. Where do they go from there?
They go from there, they make a determination as to how far ahead a person could see. What I'm trying to do is make it clear that Mr. Johnson was driving beyond his visibility or his ability to see. It seems to me that if your stopping distance is longer than the distance you can see ahead of you, that you are creating a danger to those folks that are outside of your stopping or outside of your visibility, but within your stopping distance. And that, I think, is something that may go more to the foreseeability issue, but that's something I'm trying to convince folks of that are reviewing this, that it seems to me that is an apparent danger. But what the Court of Appeals should have done is take that, go through the calculations as I have in my file or in my application and the other briefs I've provided to them, to see at that non-negligent speed, could Lofton have cleared the lane of traffic in that quarter of a second, at the non-negligent speed, so that Mr. Johnson would have, although it may have been close, Mr. Johnson would have gone on through, Mr. Lofton would have cleared and gone on down the road, and there would have been no accident. That's the analysis, as I understand, the Supreme Court in Biggers that was made. And when you review it, that's the only real analysis that can be made in stark contrast to the position that the Court of Appeals has taken, that you look solely at the time to take evasive action. That can't be the law.
It's not really the use of terms like irrefutable jumping out in front of someone, but your view is the Court of Appeals ignored the Biggers standard, and if they apply the Biggers standard, given the record in this case, there's no way that they can reach the conclusion that there's insufficient evidence.
Yes, sir, that's exactly right. Not only on the cause and fact element, but also on the foreseeability element. And I've running out of time, but I've tried to set that out, and I've alluded to that just a second ago as to the foreseeability element and trying to reconstruct. The Supreme Court has even admonished appellate courts in that Biggers case again, that although they may like to try to do something different, if there is a way that you can look at the evidence in a credible manner and review it in that way, although you may not like the result of it, and I may not be saying the words exactly right, but although you may not agree with it, if that is a reasonable way or a valid way to look at the evidence, then you cannot deny the jury that the availability of that procedure, that method to look at. And that's what we're getting at. The time-space factor, just want to make two comments about that. I think it is highly improper for a court to develop without any evidence what their perception of the law of mathematics and physics is. Regardless of if it's proper or not, their recitation of the law of physics and mathematics is incorrect. If you take it in theory in the way that they wanted it to be, or the way at least I perceive they wanted it to be presented to us. They made a comment that we must further recognize and acknowledge that there arises in every potential collision between two masses a point in time where there is insufficient space between the masses in which to apply the forces that will alter speed, etc. They apply to every situation. And we can envision situations where that simply is not the case. Plus, if it applies only to the only to an automobile situation, they have factored out the human factor, the road conditions, they factored out the weather conditions that would obviously play a very important part on it.
Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument from respondents.
May it please the court, Mr. Townsend will present argument for the respondents.
May it please the court. There is no more common nor dangerous tendency in the law than to take language and holdings from prior cases out of the procedural context in which they were made. And yet courts persist in doing it, attorneys persist in doing it, I myself have done it to this court, we all do it, but it is a tendency we have to be on guard against. That tendency is at work in this case in two very fundamental ways. First of all, is his proximate cause argument, and specifically the Biggers case that he continues to talk about, his alleged white horse case. Biggers is a no evidence case. It applies a no evidence standard of review. It's very explicit in doing so. At page 369 of the Biggers opinion, it says, quote, the court should have no hesitancy in reversing the judgment and remanding the cause for a new trial if it thinks the evidence is factually insufficient. What happened is the Court of Appeals held there was no evidence, did not rule on the factual insufficiency point. Supreme Court reviewed it, said, yes, there is some evidence, but you, the Court of Appeals, have the final decision on remand whether it is factually insufficient. All his talk about the bigger standard and whether our Court of Appeals applied it in this case is irrelevant because they were conducting a factual sufficiency review rather than the Biggers no evidence standard of review. This court has held in City of Gladewater versus Pike that proximate cause consists of the two elements we all know, but for causation and foreseeability. But the court then went on to say that proximate cause and the application of those two principles depends on the facts of the case. That very statement by this court recognizes that proximate cause is subject to varying interpretations and fact findings. And indeed, in the Baumler case, which was cited in our brief, the Supreme Court held that speed is not always a proximate cause of an accident, and it distinguished Biggers on those very grounds. Baumler, the Supreme Court of Texas in 1961, said that speed can be a proximate cause or it cannot be, and the Court of Appeals has the final decision over the fact issues involved in that inquiry. Given that we are on review of a Court of Appeals holding that the evidence is factually insufficient, why are we here? Recall that the accident occurred in January of 1981. It got to trial fairly quickly, March 83. The first Court of Appeals opinion remanding it for a new trial was April of 1985. We're here 4 years later, and we've never had that second trial that the Court of Appeals said should be ordered. We've had a ping-pong game between the appellate court and the Supreme Court for 4 years, and I submit to you we could have had the case tried and appealed twice since then. We are here.
The short answer is we're here because of an allegation of perhaps some belief on some members of the Court of Appeals misapplied the correct understanding.
We are here, Your Honor, I submit, because as you noted in your concurring opinion in the Poole case, we're being asked to second-guess the Courts of Appeals. And you're seeing that in many applications filed up here. I filed some of them myself. Because of your decision in the Poole case, you're continually being asked either to set aside Court of Appeals reversals of jury verdicts, or if the Court of Appeals refuses to reverse on sufficiency grounds, then we all allege that they applied the wrong standard. You are getting involved in reviewing the Courts of Appeals. And the truth of the matter, I don't want to pick a fight with you, but you were wrong in Poole, and demonstrably so. And that's what I'm going to do today, is try to demonstrate that to you. You have no jurisdiction to review the granting of a new trial by the Court of Appeals on sufficiency grounds. This is not a new idea. Justice Garwood's 1952 article says as much. It's only new because recent decisions have misread the older decisions and have expanded the concept until you think you do have jurisdiction. Probably the most cited case in Texas is N. Ray King's estate. It looks like Marbury versus Madison and Shepherd's, hundreds of citations to it. N. Ray King's estate was a per curiam opinion without oral argument, and the sole holding of the case was that if you raise a factual sufficiency point in the Court of Appeals, it cannot apply a no evidence standard of review in denying that point. The analogy being that the Court of Appeals had not even addressed the petitioner's point of error. He had a factual sufficiency point. It treated it as a no evidence point. This court sent it back for review as a factual sufficiency point. In truth, N. Ray King's estate, rather than talking about standard of review, talks about scope of review. Scope of review being what materials do you, the Court of Appeals, look at in making up your mind. It does not tell them the standard of review, which is how do you make up your mind. N. Ray King's
estate... So in other words, if the Court of Appeals, for example, in this case, had said, well, there's some evidence to the contrary, but we're not going to consider that in making our decision, or even if they didn't say so expressly, it was obvious that's what they did, there might be a problem there.
There might be a problem. I think as a practical rule, you should insist more on the expressness of the test, because if you don't, a petitioner will always argue that they didn't consider this one little bit of evidence just because it's not mentioned in the opinion. And the result will be that appellate courts will start attaching the entire statement of facts as an appendix to their opinion, saying even though we don't mention every single sentence that was said, we did consider all these matters.
Counsel, we've had hundreds of cases appealed under the current Poole decision, We've not had the kind of problems you've been describing.
Well, I don't know how
your courts of appeals have, with regularity, have enumerated the evidence on both sides in the context of insufficient evidence points and have ruled on them.
That's true.
We haven't reversed those.
No, but you've had to look at them, haven't you, Your Honor?
Well, we've had to look at them anyway.
Well, no, not on these grounds. You would not have had to look at the facts and the application of law to facts. That's where we differ from Poole.
So we were unwise in what we did because it created more work for us?
No. That's certainly a byproduct of it that you're free to consider, but you were unwise to do what you did in Poole because it was an unconstitutional usurpation of the appellate court's jurisdiction.
And you're saying that we disagree with the Court of Appeals assessment of sufficiency of the evidence, then we can grant writ and take a gift for the Court of Appeals.
That's what you're being asked to do. That's what you cannot do.
Like I predicted, Brandon.
That's right. What you should be doing is what you did in the Dyson case. And if you'll recall the context here, Poole relied heavily on Dyson because Dyson was the first time, to my recollection, that this court brought up a point about the right to a jury trial and sufficiency of review. And I think, Justice Ray, you were one of the concurring members there. And Dyson, however, involved a situation where the Court of Appeals stated the wrong principle of law. It was stating a gross negligence standard, and it stated it in terms of ordinary negligence. And the Supreme Court said it is obvious that the Court of Appeals did not even recognize the correct principle of law. Here's the correct definition of gross negligence. You guys now go apply it. Poole goes beyond that. Poole says we're going to look at how you apply it rather than just what legal principle did you use. That's where you're making a mistake. Because when you get into reviewing the application of law to fact, as City of Gladewater versus Pike said, you are invading the province of the Court of Appeals.
Counsel, the test to be used for insufficient evidence is a legal test. Is it not?
I disagree, Your Honor.
Whatever test to be used is not a legal test,
with
a factual test?
With the
exception. Unbridled discretion of the Court of Appeals, and you would ask us to change Poole and revert back to the problems we had before Poole, that was where Courts of Appeals were reversing for insufficient evidence, for mandatory neutrality, given no explanation whatsoever, just in it as a whim.
No, Your Honor. You have the mechanism in the rules to require them to state their reasons. Rule 90A requires the Courts of Appeals to issue opinions on all dispositive points and explain the reasons. You don't have to do it in terms of a standard of review analysis.
Poole is just an extension of that rule.
Poole is wrong, Your
Honor. You're asking us to change the law and overrule Poole. I'm hearing you loud and clear.
I think you can explain Poole rather than overrule it, but certainly if you want to overrule it, I urge you. But if you don't want to overrule it, you can certainly explain. Poole, here's another error in Poole. It says that, and we've all paid lip service to this, you have jurisdiction to review the legal standards by which the Court of Appeals weighs the evidence. And it cites Garza versus Alvear, perhaps the second most cited case in Texas. Garza has nothing to do with that. I read it at 11 o'clock Monday night, and a light went on in my head because I've never cited it correctly. I've never seen it cited correctly. The only holding in Garza versus Alvear is that the Court of Appeals cannot reverse a case on unassigned error. What happened is the Court of Appeals sent the case back for a new trial, holding the evidence is insufficient. And the Supreme Court begins its analysis by saying, we don't know what they meant by insufficient. Is it legally or factually? They looked at it. They said, well, they sent it back for a new trial, so we're going to presume that they meant it was factually insufficient. And then the rest of the opinion says, you can't do that because there was no point of error complaining of the factual insufficiency of the evidence. Hardly a remarkable proposition, one that has nothing to do with the standard of review. And yet Poole misread Garza to say that you did have jurisdiction to review the standards applied by the Court of Appeals. The only standard that they have to apply is the one of clearly unjust, and you can't tell them how to determine that. You can simply ensure that they do say that in their opinion, that they do think it's clearly unjust. It's supported by history, by the constitutional amendment. Last summer, you wrote Cropper, Herbert, Hurlbut, all those cases on this issue. You went through all the ancient history. It was clear that the Supreme Court, before 1891, was exercising jurisdiction to reverse jury verdicts that were clearly wrong. The Summers case is an example. 1891 constitutional amendment gives that power to the courts of appeals. Most importantly, and something that I think only Justice Ray mentioned in his one's concurring opinions, it took that power from the Supreme Court. It didn't just give a concurrent power. It gave it to the courts of appeals, took it from the Supreme Court. That power is stated in the Constitution that their decision on the facts shall be conclusive. That's why we see language that the courts of appeals can unfind facts but cannot find facts. They can't find facts because they have no power to render judgment. If they could find facts, as he's asking you to find a non-negligent speed, or that the Court of Appeals should find a non-negligent speed, then they could go ahead and render judgment. They can't do that. They can only unfind and they can only remand. This is also where you see language that has cropped up recently that says you cannot substitute your thought processes for the jury. You can't reverse a case where reasonable minds could conflict. There's a real problem with that language. First of all, Justice Garwood's 1952 article says, yes, indeed, that is what the Court of Appeals can do. They have to put their minds in the place of the jury to determine whether an unjust verdict has been reached. But more importantly, it's not a novel thing. It's done every day. When this court reverses a case for the exclusion of evidence, I'm sorry, when you affirm on the exclusion and you say it's harmless because the evidence is cumulative of other evidence in the record, you are putting yourselves in the place of the jury. You are saying that if we were on the jury, we would not believe this one additional bit of evidence that was excluded because the jury has already disbelieved these other pieces of evidence. And yet your own decisions at the same time say the jury is free to accept or reject all or part of a party's evidence. And I don't have a problem with your review in the harmless error doctrine in doing that. My point is simply this right to a jury trial is being violated every day. It is not a pure right. And the most important thing I can say about this is when you go back to the cases where this language originates, specifically Benoit versus Wilson, very eloquent expression by the Supreme Court that a jury can believe all or part of a witness's testimony, disbelieve part, some witnesses, not others. Benoit is a no evidence standard of review. It is explicit in the opinion. It's even couched in terms of this court, meaning the Supreme Court, cannot disbelieve part of a witness's testimony, can't set over a jury finding because the jury can do that. It says nothing about the power of the courts of appeals to review the evidence. As Chief Justice Phillips pointed out in his concurrence in the Herbert case, the courts of appeals must have this power to correct unjust verdicts, especially now because the rules have taken away the right to show jury misconduct. Under the current rules, a jury can render a quotient verdict, can disregard the judge's instructions, can go to the scene of the accident, can talk about insurance, and the evidence of that is not even admissible, much less a source of error. Without the power to set aside these jury verdicts, a party does not have a right to a fair trial. It has only a right to a trial. Whether it's fair or not is simply an accident to the trustworthiness of the jurors. The ultimate safeguard on the appellate court's process in setting aside jury verdicts for factual insufficiency is in Rule 326. I call it the three strikes you're out rule. You can only have two new trials granted on the basis of insufficient evidence. If you lose the third time, there's nothing anybody can do about it. That's the ultimate safeguard.
This is all very provocative. Obviously, it reflects careful thought on your part, but if five members of the court are not persuaded of this argument, then do you lose this case?
No, Your Honor, I don't think so.
Well, would you make a few remarks on how a follower of Poole might be persuaded that the Court of Appeals was acting within its proper scope?
Precisely. In our case, we are involved not with the declaration of a legal principle, but with the application of standard principles to the facts of the case. The Court of Appeals, in its original opinion, and again in its second opinion, and together with all the concurrences, very many opinions in the case, they set forth the same rules, proximate cause, that this court has always announced, recognize the same factors. The only difference between what the Court of Appeals did and the petitioner is that the Court of Appeals reaches a different conclusion when it applies the law to those facts. The Court of Appeals recites the testimony of all the witnesses. It did not recite testimony of damages witnesses, but that I would think would be irrelevant to our case, and that's not been complained of. Given that the Court of Appeals is applying the correct rules of law to the facts of this case, I don't think you have any power to do anything but affirm. Obviously, if you disagree, you have the power to send it back to the Court of Appeals and let them write it one more time. I don't think that would be a just result. I think we all know what would happen there, and we'd have further delay in this case. So I'm really asking the court to affirm. If you want to dismiss the application as improvidently granted, you can certainly do that. But I think if you look back at Poole and then Garza and N. Ray King's estate, you will see a mistake was made when it talks about reviewing the application of standards, that you don't have the power to do that. There is no need for you to do that, and it does not serve the interests of justice.
Let me ask you one more question, but I'm intrigued by your argument. What should we have written in Poole? How would you have said it?
In Poole, the issue was simply whether the court had really engaged in any thought processes in reaching its decision. And I think it should have been written under Rule 90A that a court of appeals must address the points of error and show some kind of thought processes, and not just a conclusory statement, but that we have looked at the facts, we've looked at the law, and this is how we get there. And another problem with Poole is that it's only written one way. As it is, if the court overrules the point, it doesn't have to say anything. It's only if it grants the point that it has to lay out this involved discussion of the evidence. And I think the problem is really that you want to have written opinions that show the Court of Appeals is familiar with the case and the law, and for the party's benefit, to let them know that some rational thought processes have been engaged in here. And that should apply regardless of whether the judgment is affirmed or reversed. I don't think you have to go through all the evidence. I think it would be sufficient if you could just say, here's one piece of evidence, and to us this is sufficient to support the verdict, or here's something in the record that we think renders this judgment clearly unjust. And if you do that, then I think at least the parties believe that the court did study the case.
So what you're saying is the Supreme Court does not have a right to say what the standards are that the Court of Appeals must use in reviewing that evidence.
That's correct. The standard is really one of clearly unjust. That's really what the standard. The scope is you look at all the evidence. The standard is clearly unjust. And the reason that the standard is that is because of the pre-1891 history. That's what this court was doing. When the amendment came, that same power transferred to the Court of Appeals.
Are you saying we're frozen to the standard that existed in 1891? In other words,
yes.
We can't change that standard.
I think that's correct.
The Court of Appeals change it?
Court of Appeals could.
So 14 different Court of Appeals could decide that the Supreme Court was wrong in 1891. Whatever in 1891 it changed. I think it changed in the middle of the year.
Yeah.
They were wrong in 1891, and here's a new standard. You could have 14 different standards, and in Houston, the Court of Appeals would just completely second-guess the case, and in Dallas, they could have a fool-type analysis that had to shock the conscience of every living American, and that would just be that.
Well, I think there are two different issues there, and let me address both of them, because I was answering your second one and not focusing on the first one. The answer to the second one, the problem of 14 different decisions, is no different than the problem we have now with trial judges who can grant a new trial on any basis whatsoever and don't even have to give a reason. So you could have 300 or 400, however many district judges there are, applying different standards. The test is just really, does that judge think it's unjust? And I suppose one could say, since we have elected judges in Texas, there's theoretically a remedy with the populace if they don't like the way the judges are applying the law. Your first point about the standard, no, I think the standard has to be clearly unjust because that's a matter of constitutional power that was in existence before the courts of appeals had this jurisdiction that you, the Supreme Court...
Those words are in the Constitution.
Well,
it will have jurisdiction over the facts.
It was determined by the Supreme Court in 1840, I think, that was the standard that they had to use. So to that extent, it's engrafted on the Constitution. Now, the decision as to whether something is clearly unjust, yes, you can have 14 different determinations of that that this court has no power to review.
I find it somewhat unusual that Taxi Bryan would stand here and request that there be an affirmance, and the only way that it can be done is to overrule years and years of precedent that has come down from this court. I myself would rather have a court reviewing a court of appeals if the court of appeals applies the wrong standard than not having the appeal for the review of that type of incorrect application of the law. And that's what is involved here, it seems to me. Failing that, then Taxi Bryan would have the court affirm, if you read, or at least if I'm understanding correctly, the Supreme Court is asked to affirm simply to get the case over with, not correcting the difficulties that Andy Lofton has pointed out to the court that occurred in the Court of Appeals. I find that very discouraging, to say the least, but that would be a means by which this case could be over with. If time is a factor, then Taxi Bryan, and if Taxi Bryan is tired of being on appeal, and they could have paid Andy Lofton 7 years ago or 6 years ago the judgment that he won in the trial court. But be that as it may, Mr. Townsend cited the standard by which we all know, and that is Court of Appeals cannot substitute, or the court cannot substitute their judgment for that of the jury in connection with the facts, etc. I remind the court, I don't know what difference it makes, maybe none, but out of 19 people that have made the decision as to who is prevailing in this case, 17 found for Andy Lofton, and 2 found for Taxi Bryan, and that's why we're here too. In reviewing the request that Texas Brian now makes to change pool, I do not have on the tip of my tongue, as Mr. Townsend does, the names of the cases and who decided what. I apologize for that. I didn't realize that we were going to get into a philosophical discussion as to what the law or pool and alm and those decisions. However, I do remember a decision by the court or a comment by one of the justices that when the decision came out questioning the validity of the review standard, that it was fashionable, and I think that was the word used, for lawyers to come in try to get that changed. And apparently this court was inundated with a number of requests. The comment that was made, as I recall it, was that we have had a number of these requests and we declined to do that, that the standards by which we have applied are proper. And again, I am one that would request that the court review the mistakes in the application of the law that the Court of Appeals made, and that apparently at least somebody on the court feels that there was also enough evidence or enough reason to consider it by granting the application for the variance. Because if the appellate court flaunts the court's ruling, then that should be reviewed. And I do remind the court that one of the very comments that were criticized by this court 2 years ago was the comment by the Court of Appeals that you should not make conclusory statements about jumping in front of somebody, and yet the Court of Appeals, after rebriefing and re-arguing and having the very decision in front of them at the time they read it, or at the time that they wrote their subsequent opinion, they again repeated, it's not right, they repeated their comments that were criticized earlier. Thank you.
Any questions? Thank you, Joe. That concludes the second argument. The court will take another recess.